Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin with a poem from the December 28, 2020 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Greetings, Friends, by Ian Fraser. Friends, one and all, let us unmute, excite the timbrel and the lute, make merry with our pots and pan, the hour is seven, so we can. Shout from the balcony or lawn for joy at what will soon be gone, and praises sing for what is here, the end to this undreamt of year. Commune with us, dear friends, while we strew gifts abundant round the tree, and help us pick out something nice for New York's Dr. David Price, the Bronx's Dr. Ernest Patty, every nurse in Cincinnati, Dr. L. Woodward of U of Miss, Dr. Purnell, she's our own Chris, L.A.'s Dr. Anna Darby, Arizona's Dr. Barbie, Harold Varmus, the Nobeller, doc of reputation, stellar, Ashley Bartholomew, R.N., and when we check the list again, it scrolls out across the floor with healthcare stalwarts by the score. By the millions, heroes true, forgive their student loan debts, do. As we replay 2-0 in slow-mo, a Christmas cheer for Andrew Cuomo. Is not amiss, nor would it be, for bat virologist Jing Lishi. Stake Diane, the cool mask maker, Dolly Parton, Peter Baker, Jennifer O'Malley Dillon, Issa Rae, Calvin Bud Trillin, Stacey Abrams, Mikey Sherrill, Andrew Ray, and Colin Farrell. The passing comet Neowise, which, lacking hands, can't sanitize. Them yearns to be the white wise man's star instead and shining from afar. Lays tender beams upon a Blinken, Dr. Fauci, and we're thinking. Two on David Miliband, Alelia Bundles, Michael Land, Gretchen Whitmer, Fearless Gov, John Ossoff, whom we're so fond of, Chris Krebs and Tyler, the Creator, brightly and not one bit later, it shines on Amy Westervelt, whose podcast we have always felt, is great on Alice Oswald, too, and similarly on a few deserving folks like James McBride, Fern Finkel, Brooklyn's Courtroom Pride, Reed Singer, Mr. Brokaw, Tom, Meg Knox, and wondrous Rosa Baum. Yay for Jack and Marta Handy, and our old pal Peter Canby. A super surge of Christmas glee to Joe and Jill from me and thee, and all good things to Kamala and Doug from us and Mama Law. This year, just in case you've wondered, Roger Angel turned 100. Unequaled master of this rhyme from back when it was in its prime, he rocks. And so does Peggy Moorman, who is the best, and that's for sure, man. To those who lift us up, Godspeed. We hope Josh Gad has all he'll need. For Alexander Vindman and bro Yevgeny, we've a plan to wish them both benignity and with no loss of dignity. Shout season's blessings to Jack Black, mystery writer Stephen Womack, Jay Inslee, John Hickenlooper, David Chichester, Chris Cooper, with, by the by, a friendly hi to VP Pence's pensive fly. Should Christmas comfort be deployed, may it descend on Terrence Floyd, Felonious Floyd and their relations. Rev Al, thanks for your oration. May peace, whatever peace there be, enfold the family, Arbery. May justice come to all who thirst and hunger for it through the worst. Dear friends, if we could rhyme away the year's vast losses, we might say these stumbling lines were justified as right in step with Christmastide. Does meter link up hope and history? The only rhyme word here is mystery. Let gladness rise despite. Love one another, routs the night. And kindness is a folding chair we carry with us everywhere. In depth of winter, prospects brighten, mighty streams of light will lighten the miles ahead, and goodness reign once more, the angels' grand refrain. Next, from the daily comment section of the online edition of the New Yorker magazine, December 20, 2020, an Advent lament in the pandemic. COVID-19 has held a mirror to Christianity, just as the epidemics of the past did, by Michael Luo. In the Christian liturgical calendar, the weeks leading up to Christmas, when Advent is observed, are meant to be a season of anticipation. A stanza in the carol O Holy Night, often sung during Christmas Eve Mass, conveys an intense longing for the Savior's arrival. A thrill of hope, the weary world rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn. That sense of weighty expectation feels heightened this year as a fragile, disputatious America prepares for an enormous mobilization to manufacture and distribute hundreds of millions of vaccine doses to finally bring the pandemic under control. The passage in the Book of Common Prayer for the fourth Sunday in Advent reads as a collective yearning. O Lord, raise up, we pray thee, thy power, and come among us, and with great might succor us. It has been, to a distressing degree, an ignominious year for the church in America. In the midst of a global public health crisis, many Christians certainly took seriously Jesus' teaching in the Gospel of Matthew about how he would separate believers from non-believers on Judgment Day. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. My colleague, Jonathan Blitzer, profiled Juan Carlos Ruiz, a 50-year-old Mexican pastor of a Lutheran congregation in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, who tirelessly delivered meals, arranged discounted burials with funeral homes, and answered calls for help at all hours from undocumented members of the community. Legions of Roman Catholic priests donned personal protective equipment and ventured, at great personal risk, into hospital rooms to anoint the dying with oil. Churches have operated food pantries, distributed rent relief checks, and provided housing during the crisis. But white evangelical Protestants, once again, overwhelmingly supported President Trump in the election. Despite his denialism about the pandemic, which has now killed more than 300,000 people in the United States, and his utter lack of compassion for its victims. Many churches, particularly conservative ones, fought lockdown orders and rebuffed public health warnings about large indoor gatherings. The virus has swept through houses of worship across the country. In the end, the lasting image of the church in the pandemic may very well be that of an unmasked choir at First Baptist Church in Dallas, led by the pastor Robert Jeffress, a staunch Trump supporter, singing in front of Vice President Mike Pence at a Freedom Sunday service, as the country where the church is located reported a record high for COVID-19 cases. As Christians prepare anew to celebrate the Incarnation, when the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us, revisiting early church history offers a reminder of the devotion to the common good that Jesus' life, death, and resurrection can inspire. In the year 165, a horrible pandemic, sometimes referred to as the Plague of Galen, for the physician who described the illness in his writings, struck the Roman Empire. By some estimates, a quarter to a third of the population died. Nearly a century later, another pestilence devastated the region, killing as many as 5,000 people a day in Rome. Dionysius, the bishop of the church in Alexandria, where two-thirds of the population may have died, mounted a broad effort to tend to the sick. Most of our brother Christians showed unbounded love and loyalty, never sparing themselves and thinking only of one another, he wrote in an Easter letter to his flock. Heedless of danger, they took charge of the sick, attending to their every need and ministering to them in Christ, and with them departed this life serenely happy. For they were infected by others with the disease, drawing on themselves the sickness of their neighbors and cheerfully accepting their pains. Dionysius contrasted the behavior of believers to that of pagans, who pushed the sufferers away and fled from their dearest, throwing them into the roads before they were dead, and treated unburied corpses as dirt, hoping thereby to avert the spread and contagion of the fatal disease. Accounts of works of mercy by followers of Jesus were not limited to Christian sources. Nearly a century later, Emperor Julian, seeking to bolster paganism, urged the high priest of Galatia to emulate the charitable works of Christians, attributing the growth of the impious Galileans to benevolence toward strangers and care for the graves of the dead, and how they support not only their poor, but ours as well. The historian Timothy S. Miller, in his book, The Birth of the Hospital in the Byzantine Empire, documents how the first public hospitals began to spring up in the 4th and 5th centuries as an expression of Christian charity. Basil, the bishop of Caesarea in what is now Turkey, established a charitable complex up for the destitute on the outskirts of the city that included a hostel for the sick, staffed by doctors and nurses. John Chrysostom, the Archbishop of Constantinople, the new capital of the Roman Empire, opened several hospitals in that city. During the Middle Ages, hospitals were established throughout Europe, often as a part of monastic communities. Charlemagne, who sought to convert all his subjects to Christianity, decreed that hospitals accompany every cathedral built in his kingdom. In 1527, Europe experienced a resurgence of the bubonic plague, nearly two centuries after the Black Death. As victims began appearing in the German town of Wittenberg, many chose to flee. Martin Luther, a professor of theology at the University of Wittenberg and a leader of the Protestant Reformation movement, decided to stay there to care for the sick and the dying. He later wrote an open letter, Whether One May Flee from a Deadly Plague, explaining his decision. When people are dying, they most need a spiritual ministry which strengthens and comforts their consciences by word and sacrament, and in faith overcomes death. While he believed that no one should risk his or her life needlessly, Luther described people as being bound to each other in such a way that no one may forsake the other in his distress, but is obliged to assist and help him as he himself would like to be helped. Along these lines, he noted that those who stayed should take potions which can help you, fumigate house, yard, and street, shun persons and places wherever your neighbor does not need your presence or has recovered, and act like a man who wants to help put out the burning city. He was explicit about the need for social distancing. I shall avoid places and persons where my presence is not needed in order not to become contaminated and thus perchance infect and pollute others, and so cause their death as a result of my negligence. In the rise of Christianity, Rodney Stark, a sociologist of religion, writes that the early Christians' response to epidemics helps to explain the extraordinary spread of their movement. Rudimentary nursing, in the form of providing food and water, likely led to dramatically better survival rates among Christians and those they cared for, which would have seemed nothing short of miraculous amid so much suffering and death. Starks argues that differing mortality rates would have then begun to shift the demographics in the Roman world between Christians and pagans and led to further conversion opportunities. He points out that Christianity provided adherents hope and consolation, and that, more important, the Christian way appeared to work. While Stark considers a variety of other social factors, his conclusion is that the ultimate impetus for Christianity becoming the dominant faith in the Western world, a few centuries after Jesus' birth, was the doctrines of the religion itself and the attractive, liberating, and effective relationships and community they produced in the early church. The Christian message of a God who loved humanity and therefore expected his followers to love one another, and non-believers too, Stark writes, was something entirely new in antiquity. In 2020, many churches realized that the best way they could love their neighbors was to temporarily shut their doors. Early in the pandemic, the National Association of Evangelicals and Christianity Today issued a statement calling on churches to close out of deep sense of responsibility for others. The Reverend Rick Warren, the senior pastor of Saddleback Church, a megachurch based in Orange County, California, encouraged his congregants to meet online in smaller Bible study groups, volunteer at pop-up food pantries, and tune into virtual services on Sunday. But he kept his many campuses closed, pointing out that the church is not a building. Shepherds, that's what pastors mean, are called to protect God's flock, not expose it to danger. And I'm not willing to risk people's health just to have a live audience to speak to. Warren told me in an email, but other church leaders resumed in-person services even as infections surged, often while waving the banner of religious freedom. For years, the church in America has been in retreat, in cultural influence and in numbers. According to a survey by the Pew Research Center in 2019, 65% of Americans identified as Christians, down 12% from the previous decade. Meanwhile, the numbers of the religiously unaffiliated have grown to 26%. The co-opting of white evangelicalism by Republican politics helps to explain the confrontational attitude of conservative Christians, but so does the fear of many believers that they are losing their place in a secularizing America. A pluralistic society needs to ensure that people of faith, as well as those without any faith, have a role in the public square. But the defiance of the church during the pandemic has come with a cost. The pandemic in 2020 has held a mirror to Christianity, just as the epidemics of antiquity did. But today's reflection carries the potential to repulse rather than attract. Once the vaccine is widely distributed next year, the church, along with the rest of society, will begin to move on. Yet the world will not be as it was. Churches will have to reckon not only with whether their congregants will return in person, but with how much their collective witness, the term Christians use to describe their ability to point to Jesus in their lives, may have been diminished. The story of Christmas is an enthralling one. A baby born of humble parentage, swaddled in clothes and cradled in a manger, is the Messiah. Toward the end of his life, Jesus was challenged by a Pharisee in Jerusalem to name the greatest commandment. He said that it was to love God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. And that the second greatest commandment was to love your neighbor as yourself. The earlier followers of Jesus realized that these admonitions were intertwined, that one led to the other. In a new book, God and the Pandemic, N.T. Wright, a New Testament scholar and retired Anglican bishop, urges the church, as it considers its role in the aftermath of the coronavirus, to champion the priorities of Psalm 72, which is written as a prayer for King Solomon. It goes as follows. May he defend the cause of the poor of the people. Give deliverance to the children of the needy and crush the oppressor. Wright admits that such a vision for society might be wishful thinking, but he writes that this is what the church at its best has always believed and taught, and what the church on the front lines has always practiced. It is also what an ailing nation needs. And now, from the fiction section of the December 24th, 1949 issue of the New Yorker magazine, "Christmas is a Sad Season for the Poor" by John Cheever. Christmas is a sad season. The phrase came to Charlie an instant after the alarm clock had waked him and named for him an amorphous depression that had troubled him all the previous evening. The sky outside his window was black. He sat up in bed and pulled the light chain that hung in front of his nose. "Christmas is a very sad day of the year," he thought. "Of all the millions of people in New York, I am practically the only one who has to get up in the cold black of 6 a.m. on Christmas Day. In the morning, I am practically the only one." He dressed, and when he went downstairs from the top floor of the rooming house in which he lived, the only sounds he heard were the coarse sounds of sleep. The only lights burning were lights that had been forgotten. Charlie ate some breakfast in an all-night lunch wagon and took an elevated train uptown. From Third Avenue, he walked over to Park. Park Avenue was dark. House after house put into the shine of the streetlights a wall of black windows. Millions and millions were sleeping. And this general loss of consciousness generated an impression of abandonment, as if this were the fall of the city, the end of time. He opened the iron and glass doors of the apartment building where he had been working for 6 months as an elevator operator, and went through the elegant lobby to a locker room at the back. He put on a striped vest with brass buttons, a false ascot, a pair of pants with a light blue stripe on the seam, and a coat. The night elevator man was dozing on the little bench in the car. Charlie woke him. The night elevator man told him thickly that the day doorman had been taken sick and wouldn't be in that day. With the doorman sick, Charlie wouldn't have any relief for lunch, and a lot of people would expect him to whistle for cabs. Charlie had been on duty a few minutes when 14 rang, a Mrs. Hewing, who he happened to know was kind of immoral. Mrs. Hewing hadn't been to bed yet, and she got into the elevator wearing a long dress under her fur coat. She was followed by her two funny-looking dogs. He took her down and watched her go out into the dark and take her dogs to the curb. She was outside for only a few minutes. Then she came in, and he took her up to 14 again. When she got off the elevator, she said, "Merry Christmas, Charlie." "Well, it isn't much of a holiday for me, Mrs. Hewing," he said. "I think Christmas is a very sad season of the year. It isn't that people around here ain't generous. I mean, I got plenty of tips. But, you see, I live alone in a furnished room, and I don't have any family or anything, and Christmas isn't much of a holiday for me." "Oh, I'm sorry, Charlie," Mrs. Hewing said. "I don't have any family myself. It is kind of sad when you're alone, isn't it?" And she called her dogs and followed them into her apartment. He went down. It was quiet then, and Charlie lighted a cigarette. The heating plant in the basement encompassed the building at that hour in a regular and profound vibration, and the sullen noises of arriving steam, heat, began to resound. First in the lobby, and then to reverberate up through all the 16 stories. But this was a mechanical awakening, and it didn't lighten his loneliness or his petulance. The black air outside the glass doors had begun to turn blue, but the blue light seemed to have no source. It appeared in the middle of the air. It was a tearful light, and as it picked out the empty street and the long file of Christmas trees, he wanted to cry. Then a cab drove up, And the waltzers got out, drunk and dressed in evening clothes, and he took them up to their penthouse. The waltzers got him to brooding about the difference between his life in a furnished room and the lives of the people overhead. It was terrible. Then the early churchgoers began to ring, but there were only three of these that morning. A few went off to church at 8 o'clock, but the majority of the building remained unconscious, although the smell of bacon and coffee had begun to drift into the elevator shaft. At a little after 9, a nursemaid came down with a child. Both the nursemaid and the child had a deep tan and had just returned, he knew, from Bermuda. He had never been to Bermuda. He, Charlie, was a prisoner, confined 8 hours a day to a 6x8 elevator cage, which was confined, interned, to a 16-story shaft. In one building or another, he had made his living as an elevator operator for 10 years. He estimated the average trip at about an eighth of a mile, and when he thought of the thousands of miles he had traveled, when he thought that he might have driven the car through the mist above the Caribbean and set it down on some coral beach in Bermuda, he held the narrowness of his travels against his passengers, as if it were not the nature of the elevator, but the pressure of their lives that confined him, as if they had clipped his wings. He was thinking about this when the DePauls on 9 rang. They wished him a Merry Christmas. "Well, it's nice of you to think of me," he said as they descended, "but it isn't much of a holiday for me. Christmas is a sad season when you're poor. I live alone in a furnished room. I don't have any family." "Well, who do you have dinner with, Charlie?" Mrs. DePaul asked. "I don't have any Christmas dinner," Charlie said. "I just get a sandwich."
"Oh, Charlie!" Mrs. DePaul was a stout woman with an impulsive heart, and Charlie's plaint struck at her holiday mood as if she had been caught in a cloudburst. "I do wish we could share our Christmas dinner with you, you know," she said. "I come from Vermont, you know, and when I was a child, you know, we always used to have a great many people at our table. The mailman, you know, and the school teacher, and just about anybody who didn't have any family of their own, you know. And I wish we could share our dinner with you the way we used to, you know. And I don't see any reason why we can't. We can't have you at the table, you know, because you couldn't leave the elevator, could you? But just as soon as Mrs. DePaul has carved the goose, I'll give you a ring, and I'll arrange a tray for you, you know. And I want you to come up and at least share our Christmas dinner." Charlie thanked them, and their generosity surprised him. But he wondered if, with the arrival of friends and relatives, they wouldn't forget their offer. Then old Mrs. Gladshill rang, and when she wished him a Merry Christmas, he hung his head.
"It isn't much of a holiday for me, Mrs. Gladshill," he said. "Christmas is a sad season if you're poor. You see, I don't have any family. I live alone in a furnished room."
"Well, I don't have any family either, Charlie," Mrs. Gladshill said. She spoke with a pointed lack of petulance, but her grace was forced. "That is, I don't have any children with me today. I have 3 children and 7 grandchildren, but none of them can see their way to coming east for Christmas with me. Of course, I understand their problems. I know that it's difficult to travel with children during the holidays, although I always seem to manage it when I was their age, but people feel differently, and we mustn't condemn them for the things we can't understand. But I know how you feel, Charlie. I haven't any family either. I'm just as lonely as you."
Mrs. Gladshill's speech didn't move him. Maybe she was lonely, but she had a 10-room apartment and 3 servants and bucks and bucks and diamonds, and there were plenty of poor kids in the slum who would be happy at a chance at the food her cook threw away. Then he thought about poor kids. He sat down on a chair in the lobby and thought about them. They got the worst of it. Beginning in the fall, there was all this excitement about Christmas and how it was a day for them. After Thanksgiving, they couldn't miss it. It was so fixed that they couldn't miss it at all.
The wreaths and decorations everywhere, and bells ringing, and trees in the park, and Santa Clauses on every corner, and pictures in the magazines and newspapers, and on every wall and window in the city. They all told them that if they were good, they would get what they wanted. Even if they couldn't read, they couldn't miss it. They couldn't miss it even if they were blind. It got under the air the poor kids inhaled. Every time they took a walk, they'd see all the expensive toys in the store windows, and they'd write letters to Santa Claus, and their mothers and fathers would promise to mail them, and after the kids had gone to sleep, they'd burn the letters in the stove. And when it came Christmas morning, how could you explain it? How could you tell them that Santa Claus only visited the rich, that he didn't know about the good? How could you face them when all you had to give them was a balloon or a lollipop? On the way home from work a few nights earlier, Charlie had seen a woman and a little girl going down 59th Street. The little girl was crying. He guessed she was crying. He knew she was crying because she'd seen all the things in the toy store windows and couldn't understand why none of them were for her. Her mother did housework, he guessed, or maybe was a waitress. And he saw them going back to a room like his, with green walls and no heat, on Christmas Eve, to eat a can of soup. And he saw the little girl hang up her ragged stocking and fall asleep, and he saw the mother looking through her purse for something to put into the stocking. This reverie was interrupted by a bell on 11. He went up, and Mr. and Mrs. Fuller were waiting. When they wished him a Merry Christmas, he said, "Well, it isn't much of a holiday for me, Mrs. Fuller. Christmas is a sad season when you're poor." "Would you have any children, Charlie?" Mrs. Fuller asked. 4 living," he said, "2 in the grave." The majesty of his life overwhelmed him. "Mrs. Leary's a cripple," he added. "How sad, Charlie," Mrs. Fuller said. She started out of the elevator when it reached the lobby, and then she turned. "I want to give your children some presents, Charlie," she said. "Mr. Fuller and I are going to pay a call now, but when we come back, I want you to give you some things for your children." He thanked her. Then the bell rang on 4, and he went up to get the Westons. "It isn't much of a holiday for me," he told them when they wished him a Merry Christmas. "Christmas is a sad season when you're poor. You see, I live alone in a furnished room." "Poor Charlie," Mrs. Weston said. "I know just how you feel. During the war, when Mr. Weston was away, I was all alone at Christmas. I didn't have any Christmas dinner or a tree or anything. I just scrambled myself some eggs and sat there and cried." Mr. Weston, who had gone into the lobby, called impatiently to his wife. "I know just how you feel, Charlie," Mrs. Weston said. By noon, the climate in the elevator shaft had changed from bacon and coffee to poultry and game, and the house, like an enormous complex homestead, was absorbed in the preparation for a domestic feast. The children and their nursemaids had all returned from the park. Grandmothers and aunts were arriving in limousine. Most of the people who came through the lobby were carrying packages wrapped in colored paper and were wearing their best furs and new clothes. Charlie continued to complain to most of the tenants when they wished him a Merry Christmas, changing his story from the lonely bachelor to the poor father and back again as his mood changed. But this outpouring of melancholy and the sympathy it aroused, it didn't make him feel any better. At 1:30, 9 rang, and when he went up, Mr. DePaul was standing in the door of their apartment holding a cocktail shaker and a glass.
"Here's a little Christmas cheer, Charlie," he said, and he poured Charlie a drink.
Then a maid appeared with a tray of covered dishes, and Mrs. DePaul came out of the living room. "Merry Christmas, Charlie," she said. "I had Mr. DePaul carve the goose early so that you could have some, you know. I didn't want to put the dessert on the tray because I was afraid it would melt, you know. So when we have our dessert, we'll call you." "And what is a Christmas without presents, Mr. DePaul said, and he brought a large flat box from the hall and laid it on top of the covered dishes.
You people make it seem like a real Christmas to me, Charlie said. Tears started into his eyes. Thank you. Thank you.
Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, they called, and they watched him carry his dinner and his present into the elevator. He took the tray and the box into the locker room when he got down. On the tray, there was a soup, some kind of creamed fish, and a serving of goose. The bell rang again, but before he answered it, he tore open the DePaul's box and saw that it held a dressing gown. Their generosity and their cocktail had begun to work on his brain, and he went jubilantly up to 12. Mrs. Gadshill's maid was standing in the door with a tray, and Mrs. Gadshill stood behind her. "Merry Christmas, Charlie," she said. He thanked her, and tears came into his eyes again. On the way down, he drank off the glass of sherry on Mrs. Gadshill's tray. Mrs. Gadshill's contribution was a mixed grill. He ate the lamb chop with his fingers. The bell was ringing again, and he wiped his face with a paper towel and went up to 11.
"Merry Christmas, Charlie," Mrs. Fuller said, and she was standing in the door with her arms full of packages wrapped in silver paper, just like a picture in an advertisement, and Mr. Fuller was beside her with an arm around her, and they both looked as if they were going to cry.
"Here are some things I want you to take home to your children," Mrs. Fuller said. "And here's something for Mrs. Leary, and here's something for you. And if you want to take these things out to the elevator, we'll have your dinner ready for you in a minute."
He carried the things into the elevator and came back for the tray.
"Merry Christmas, Charlie," both of the Fullers called after him as he closed the door. He took their dinner and their presents into the locker room and tore open the box that was marked for him. There was an alligator wallet in it, with Mr. Fuller's initials in the corner. Their dinner was also goose, and he ate a piece of the meat with his fingers and was washing it down with a cocktail when the bell rang. He went up again. This time it was the Westons.
"Merry Christmas, Charlie," they said, and they gave him a cup of eggnog, a turkey dinner, and a present.
Their gift was also a dressing gown. Then 7 rang, and when he went up, there was another dinner and some more toys. And then 14 rang, and when he went up, Mrs. Hewing was standing in the hall in a kind of negligee, holding a pair of riding boots in one hand and some neckties in the other. She had been crying and drinking.
"Merry Christmas, Charlie," she said tenderly. "I wanted to give you something, and I've been thinking about you all morning. And I've been all over the apartment, and these are the only things I could find that a man might want. These are the only things that Mr. Brewer left. I don't suppose you'd have any use for his riding boots, but wouldn't you like the neckties?"
Charlie took the neckties and thanked her, and hurried back to the car, for the elevator bell had rung 3 times. By 3 o'clock, Charlie had 14 dinners spread on the table and the floor of the locker room, and the bell kept ringing. Just as he started to eat one, he would have to go up and get another, and he was in the middle of the parson's roast beef when he had to go up and get the DePaul's dessert. He kept the door of the locker room closed, for he sensed that the quality of charity is exclusive, and that his friends would have been disappointed to find that they were not the only ones to try to lessen his loneliness. There were goose, turkey, chicken, pheasant, grouse, and pigeon. There were trout and salmon, creamed scallops and oysters, lobster, crab meat, whitebait, and clams. There were plum puddings, mince pies, mousses, puddles of melted ice cream, layer cakes, torten, eclairs, and 2 slices of Bavarian cream. He had dressing gowns and neckties, cufflinks, socks, and handkerchiefs, and one of the tenants had asked for his neck size and then given him 3 green shirts. There were a glass teapot filled, the label said, with jasmine honey, 4 bottles of aftershave lotion, some alabaster bookends, and a dozen steak knives. The avalanche of charity he had precipitated filled the locker room and made him hesitant now and then, as if he had touched some wellspring in the female heart that would bury him alive in food and dressing gowns. He had made almost no headway on the food, for all the servings were preternaturally large, as if loneliness had been counted on to generate in him a brutish appetite. Nor had he opened any of the presents that had been given to him for his imaginary children. But he had drunk everything they sent down, and around him were the dregs of martinis, Manhattans, old fashions, champagne and raspberry shrub cocktails, eggnogs, Bronxes, and sidecars. His face was blazing. He loved the world, and the world loved him. When he thought back over his life, it appeared to him in a rich and wonderful light, full of astonishing experiences and unusual friends. He thought that this job as an elevator operator, cruising up and down through hundreds of feet of perilous space, demanded the nerve and the intellect of a birdman. All the constraints of his life, the green walls of his room, and the months of unemployment dissolved. No one was ringing, but he got into the elevator and shot it at full speed up to the penthouse and down again, up and down to test his wonderful mastery of space. A bell rang on 12 while he was cruising, and he stopped in his flight long enough to pick up Mrs. Gadshill. As the car started to fall, he took his hands off the controls in a paroxysm of joy and shouted, "Strap on your safety belt, Mrs. Gadshill. We're going to make a loop-de-loop." Mrs. Gadshill shrieked. Then, for some reason, she sat down on the floor of the elevator. Why was her face so pale, he wondered. Why was she sitting on the floor? And she shrieked again. He grounded the car gently and cleverly, he thought, and opened the door. "I'm sorry if I scared you, Mrs. Gadshill," he said meekly. "I was only fooling." And she shrieked again. And then she ran out into the lobby, screaming for the superintendent. The superintendent fired Charlie and took over the elevator himself. The news that he was out of work stung Charlie for a minute. It was his first contact with human meanness that day. He sat down in the locker room and gnawed on a drumstick. His drinks were beginning to let him down. And while it had not yet reached him, he felt a miserable soberness in the offing. The excess of food and presence around him began to make him feel guilty and unworthy. He regretted bitterly the lie he had told about his children. He was a single man with simple needs. He had abused the goodness of the people upstairs. He was unworthy. Then, up through this drunken train of thought surged the sharp figure of his landlady and her three skinny children. He thought of them sitting in their basement room. The cheer of Christmas had passed them by. This image got him to his feet. The realization that he was in a position to give, that he could bring happiness easily to someone else, sobered him. He took a big burlap sack, which was used for collecting waste, and began to stuff it, first with his presents and then with the presents for his imaginary children. He worked with the haste of a man whose train is approaching the station, for he could hardly wait to see those long faces light up when he came to the door. He changed his clothes. And, fired by a wonderful and unfamiliar sense of power, he slung his bag over his shoulder like a regular Santa Claus, went out the back way, and took a taxi to the Lower East Side. The landlady and her children had just finished off a turkey, which had been sent to them by the local Democratic Club, and they were stuffed and uncomfortable when Charlie began pounding on the door, shouting, "Merry Christmas!" He dragged the bag in after him and dumped the presents for the children onto the floor. There were dolls and musical toys, blocks, sewing kits, an Indian suit, and a loom. And it appeared to him that, as he had hoped, his arrival in the basement dispelled its gloom. When half the presents had been opened, he gave the landlady a bathrobe and went upstairs to look over the things he had been given for himself. Now, the landlady's children had already received so many presents by the time Charlie arrived that they were confused with receiving, and it was only the landlady's intuitive grasp of the nature of charity that made her allow the children to open some of the presents while Charlie was still in the room. But as soon as he had gone, she stood between the children and the presents that were still unopened. "Now, you kids have enough already," she said. "You kids have got your share. Just look at the things you got there. Why, you ain't even played with half of them. Marianne, you ain't even looked at that doll the fire department give you. Now, a nice thing to do would be to take all this stuff that's left over to those poor people on Hudson Street, the Deckers. They ain't got nothing. A beatific light came into her face when she realized that she could give, that she could bring cheer, that she could put a healing finger on a case needier than hers. And, like Mrs. DePaul and Mrs. Weston, like Charlie himself, and like Mrs. Decker, when Mrs. Decker was to think, subsequently, of the poor Shannons, first love, then charity, and then a sense of power drove her. "Now, you kids help me get all this stuff together. Hurry, hurry, hurry," she said, for it was dark then, and she knew that we are bound, one to another, in licentious benevolence for only a single day, and that day was nearly over. She was tired, but she couldn't rest. She couldn't rest. And now, from the Department of Christmas Expectations, December 22nd and 29th, 1997 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Christmas Cards, An Indelible Holiday Gift, by John Updike. How strange it is, gut-wrenchingly strange, to realize that your parents, in a snapshot taken by memory, are younger not only than you are now, but than your own children. If I was 7 or 8 on a certain Christmas that I remember, my father would have been 39 or 40, and my mother 35 or 6. A couple of kids, really, living in her parents' house with their only child, in a depression that war's excitement and mounting public debt hadn't yet lifted. The taste of Christmas in the little Pennsylvania town of Shillington, one of the most penetrating in my life's bolted meals, was compounded of chocolate-flavored piety, as sweetly standardized as Hershey's Kisses, and a tart, refreshed awareness of where one stood on the socioeconomic scale. Since at that latitude white Christmases were a rarity, the proper atmosphere had to be created within the front parlor. An evergreen tree, more or less richly laden with decorations brought down from the attic. Beneath the tree, a Christmas yard, a miniature landscape of cotton snow and mirror ponds and encircling railroad tracks, a heap of wrapped presents, which at my age of 7 or 8 had not yet quite shed the possibility, like a glaze, that an omniscient, fast-moving Santa Claus had personally deposited them. Though we had the tree, our neighbors' trees were, in my impression, bushier, pressing against the ceiling and crowding the front windows, and more sumptuously hung with reflective balls, colored lights, and glittering tinsel. We didn't bother with tinsel. My mother, I believe, found it vulgar and messy. Though we had the yard with a lovable blue Lionel train, engine, gold car, and 2 or 3 passenger cars going round and round in tooting obedience to a cubic black transformer, friends of mine or friends of theirs had entire basements dedicated to mountainous, suburbanized mazes of tracks, switch-offs, tunnels, and toy stations. Our yard had a single tunnel through a papier-mâché mountain whose snowy crest was approached up green-sprayed sides, diagonally dented by what I understood to be sheep paths. Our pond was square, and any illusion of landscape fomented by the toy cows and cottages on its cotton banks clashed with the reality of my own huge, freckled face looking up from it when I peeked in. Though we had the presents, they seemed less numerous and luxurious than presents bestowed up and down Philadelphia Avenue in houses externally more modest than ours. On the Christmas that I painfully remember, one of the presents was a double deck of playing cards in a pretty box, whose gray surface had a fuzzy texture, and whose paper drawer was pulled out by a silken tab. I had unwrapped the box and had assumed that it was for me until my father's voice, which was almost never raised to me in disapproval or correction, gently floated down from above with the suggestion that the cards were a present from him to my mother. Well, this made sense. One of her habits, the most alarming habit she had, indeed, was to play solitaire at night at the dining table, under the stained glass chandelier. The weary gambler, she would intone theatrically, stakes her all, as she doggedly laid out the cards in their rows. Now her voice descended to me, saying that the cards were for all of us to share. And it was true. We did play cards, three-handed pinochle, and the box said pinochle on it. Nevertheless, I was humiliated, as deeply as only a child can be, to be caught trying to appropriate her present. At the same time, I thought that if there had been more presents, I would not have made such a mistake. And I was afflicted by the paltriness of this present from my father to his wife. At least I am afflicted now, or have been the hundreds of thousands of times I remembered this incident. The something pathetic about our Christmases, the something that strived and failed to live up to Shillington's Noel ideal, was bared. A pang went through me that died the moment indelibly. Some elemental, mournful triangle seemed sketched. My grandparents, those distant, grave, friendly adjuncts, are absent from the room as I remember it. My parents are above me. The presents shorn of wrapping are around me. The three rail Lionel tracks are by my knees. The tree with its resiny scent presses close. I have no memory of what I did receive that Christmas. The wooden skis, perhaps, with leather strap bindings and ever held, or a shiny children's classic that would stay unread. I feel for a moment the triangle flip. Through the little velvety box of cards, I see my parents in their poverty, their useless gentility, their unspoken plight of homelessness, their clinging to each other through such tokens and through me. I become, in my memory, their parent, looking down and precociously grieving for them. Captured in this recollection, I want to look out the window for relief at the vacant lot next to our house, at the row houses opposite. If there was no white Christmas, there was at least a public Christmas, a free 10 o'clock cartoon show at the Shillington Movie Theater, followed by a throng of us children lining up at the town hall to receive a box of chocolates from the hands of Sam Reich, the fat one of the three town policemen. I remember eating these chocolates, trying to avoid the ones with cherries at their centers, while walking up Philadelphia Avenue with the other children as they noisily boasted of their presence. I, seeming to be, as one sometimes is in a dream, tongue-tied. And finally, from the fiction section of the December 24, 1927 issue of the New Yorker magazine, A Visit from St. Nicholas in the Ernest Hemingway Manner by James Thurber. It was the night before Christmas. The house was very quiet. No creatures were stirring in the house. There weren't even any mice stirring. The stockings had been hung carefully by the chimney. The children hoped that St. Nicholas would come and fill them. The children were in their beds. Their beds were in the room next to ours. Mama and I were in our beds. Mama wore a kerchief. I had my cap on. I could hear the children moving. We didn't move. We wanted the children to think we were asleep. "Father," the children said. There was no answer. "He's there all right," they thought. "Father," they said, and banged on their beds. "What do you want?" I asked. "We have visions of sugar plums," the children said. "Go to sleep," said Mama. "We can't sleep," said the children. They stopped talking, but I could hear them moving. They made sounds. "Can you sleep?" asked the children. "No," I said. "You ought to sleep." "I know I ought to sleep." "Can we have some sugar plums?" "You can't have any sugar plums," said Mama. "We just asked you." There was a long silence. I could hear the children moving again. "Is St. Nicholas asleep?" asked the children. "No," Mama said. "Be quiet." "What the hell would he be sleeping for tonight?" I asked. "He might be," the children said. "He isn't," I said. "Let's try to sleep," said Mama. The house became quiet once more. I could hear the rustling noises the children made when they moved in their beds. Out on the lawn, a clatter arose. I got out of bed and went to the window. I opened the shutters, then I drew up the sash. The moon shone on the snow. The moon gave the luster of midday to objects in the snow. There was a miniature sleigh in the snow and 8 tiny reindeer. A little man was driving them. He was lively and quick. He whistled and shouted at the reindeer and called them by their names. Their names were Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid, Donder, and Blitzen. He told them to dash away to the top of the porch, and then he told them to dash away to the top of the wall. They did. The sleigh was full of toys. "Who is it?" Mama asked.
"Some guy," I said, "a little guy."
I pulled my head in out of the window and listened. I heard the reindeer on the roof. I could hear their hoofs pawing and prancing on the roof.
"Shut that window," said Mama.
I stood still and listened.
"What do you hear?"
"Reindeer," I said. I shut the window and walked about. It was cold. Mama sat up in the bed and looked at me.
"How will they get on the roof?" Mama asked. "Get into bed. You'll catch cold."
Mama lay down in bed. I didn't get into bed. I kept walking around.
"What do you mean they fly?" asked Mama.
"Just fly is all."
Mama turned away toward the wall. She didn't say anything. I went out into the room where the chimney was. The little man came down the chimney and stepped into the room. He was dressed all in fur. His clothes were covered with ashes and soot from the chimney. On his back was a pack, like a peddler's pack. There were toys in it. His cheeks and nose were red, and he had dimples. His eyes twinkled. His mouth was little, like a bow, and his beard was very white. Between his teeth was a stumpy pipe. The smoke from the pipe encircled his head in a wreath. He laughed, and his belly shook. It shook like a bowl of red jelly. I laughed. He winked his eye, and then he gave a twist to his head. He didn't say anything. He turned to the chimney and filled the stockings and turned away from the chimney. Laying his finger aside his nose, he gave a nod. Then he went up the chimney. I went to the chimney and looked up. I saw him get into his sleigh. He whistled at his team, and the team flew away. The team flew as lightly as thistle down. The driver called out,
"Merry Christmas and good night,"
and I went back to bed.
"What was it?" asked Mama. "St. Nicholas?" she smiled.
"Yeah," I said. She sighed and turned in the bed.
"I saw him," I said.
"Sure." "I did see him."
"Sure you saw him." She turned farther toward the wall. "Father," said the children. "There you go," Mama said. "You and your flying reindeer."
"Go to sleep," I said.
"Can we see St. Nicholas when he comes?" the children asked.
"You got to be asleep," I said. "You got to be asleep when he comes. You can't see him unless you're unconscious."
I pulled the covers over my mouth. It was warm under the covers. As I went to sleep, I wondered if Mama was right.
Well, that's it for today. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Goodbye.